My name is Michael Coates, and these conversations highlight the challenges, achievements, and societal issues within social housing. In this episode, we speak with the CEO of one of the country's biggest housing associations. We speak about growing up in the Northwest, travelling through Afghanistan as a student, and why she was so driven to have a successful career. We also talk about housing in Notting Hill, why diversity is crucial for a thriving community, and the personal impact of Grenfell. This podcast was created by Combat Pest Control in partnership with Notting Hill Genesis. Episode 4, Kate Davies. This is Breaking the Cycle. Born in Rochdale.
Yeah, I was born in Rochdale, like the co-op movement, Gracie Fields, Cyril Smith. I don't know what that means, but yes, that's where I come from. But I've been in London really since I was about 18, and this is my home, and it's the area that I work in, and it's the area I enjoy living in.
Mm, good memories, though, from Rochdale.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite fun because it's really became part of Greater Manchester, so there was plenty to do around there. They've also got the moors and the driving rain and the Pennines, if you like walking and getting really, really wet. But yeah, happy childhood and pleased really with what sort of good fortune I've had in my life.
Mm. Were you academic or were you out and about climbing trees? And
no. Well, I was quite naughty. I didn't really get serious about my education until I went to university. I only just scraped through really with the O levels and the A levels. But once I got to university, I was quite motivated and quite interested in study. Mm. But I wasn't really a child who would sort of sit down and do as they were told. I was rather independent. I think even my parents said that about me when I was little. So once I started going to university and living in London, I had quite an exciting life. Did lots of things that I perhaps hadn't been able to do before, like travel and meet different types of people, go out for meals. I mean, now my kids and my grandchildren take it for granted going out for a meal isn't anything special, but it was really quite an unusual thing to do in those days, to go to a restaurant and have a bottle of wine and stuff. So London was an opening of different experiences, eating curry for the first time, all of this sort of stuff.
But back in Rochdale, was it you and your parents?
I had a brother. Yes, or I say had because he's died, but as are both my parents. So, yeah, there was two of us and that was it. And a dog, I think. We had a dog or two. My grandma, my auntie, my father's family was very close by. And actually, in those days, it sounds like I'm absolutely ancient, but a lot of our social life was with cousins and family, you know, and you just turn up at people's doors. We never phoned first or anything. We just walk around or go around in the car. So it's quite a different lifestyle to my own children. Have got partners from all over the world, from Brazil, from Jamaica, from India. And like all the people I knew were like family and they were just from nearby village or street, you know, not far away. So it's fascinating, isn't it, how in the hyper diversity of London, people's relationships are, you know, people going out with Australians and people traveling a lot, long distances.
But community can be quite strong. Was childhood a tight community?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, my mother's mother was married to a cousin. I mean, it was actually quite
too close.
Too close, exactly. They were both called Ashworth, and I go, well, why have they got the same name? She said, well, because they were cousins. And it was like, yeah, it was quite incestuous in a way, but nice. And that doesn't really exist anymore, I don't think, that sort of really close-knit, very local friendship groups. And I think there are advantages and disadvantages, aren't there?
Yeah, definitely. And what did you, was it working class? Or
it was quite a middle-class family. My father actually had a factory in Lancashire and it produced textiles. And that was part of the Lancashire textile industry, which had been his father's business, set up in 1905. And then my father took it over when he was a pilot in the Second World War and he came back and took over the family business. So we had plenty of, you know, comfort and money and cars and everything was pretty easy in that sense. And perhaps that's meant that I could be a rebel and please myself. You know, I didn't have to fit in too much with other people's plans. But, you know, when I decided I wanted to go to university, nobody in the family had been to university, even though, as I say, we had financial security. Both my parents had done sort of what was called, I think, general certificate, which was like O-level, and then they left school. And so the idea of having someone in the family go to university was quite an unusual thing. And I remember saying to my mother, I'm going to decide to do psychology. And she had to go to the library and look that up because she didn't know what it was. In the end, I did sociology, but that was what I first planned to do.
Tell me about, just before we went live, you talked about a fundraiser at school that really had a big impact on you. Tell me a bit more about that, because it was very unusual. I've never heard anything like
it. Yeah, so in the 60s, Shelter was set up, and that was to house homeless people. And there was a big thing on the television called Cathy Come Home. I'm sure you've heard of it. And that made people quite aware of the fact that homelessness was a social problem. And we had someone come from Shelter. I think he was the chief executive. And he just gave a talk to the young people. We were about 12 or 13. And he said, we'd like you to raise money for Shelter. And what my school decided to do was to do fundraising for a whole year to try and buy a house for a family in the local area. And so we did all sorts of things like sell chocolate more expensive than it was and all sorts of stuff like that, and sponsored this, that and the other, sponsored silence, which is really tricky, and all sorts of things to try and raise money. And we were able after a year to buy a house for a family, and that was like a fantastic thing to do. That's pretty motivated. And I met that bloke again later, and then so Shelter came into existence around that kind of time. And I think for a lot of young people it was pretty horrifying. I mean, we knew about what was happening in other countries, and there was people starving in Biafra and so on. But this was so close to home. People in our rich country of England, you know, who were homeless, living on the streets or in very, very poor housing conditions. And it did motivate me. I'm not saying it was the only thing I was interested in. But when I came back to it, I remembered how I'd felt about that.
Well, I think if we expose children at an early age to social issues and don't hide them away, it can really have a big impact.
Yes.
And with that as well, you know, you talk about purpose.
Yeah.
And that drive. Was everyone involved? Was all
the school? Yeah, the whole school got behind it. The teachers, everybody. People were washing cars and stuff. And it was a bit like Bob a Job, you know, doing stuff for people. But it was very unifying. And I think it's quite interesting how that sort of, everybody felt fortunate and they felt they needed to do something for people who weren't as fortunate. And I think that's quite a good set of values, really.
Especially when it's not looked down on. You know, when it's part of something, when you're raising someone up instead of pitying someone, I think. If that
makes
sense.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? It is tricky. But it was an identification that, you know, it could have been. In the Cathy Come Home, you know, they start off a sort of normal working class family and then they end up in a tent. You know, that their luck is bad, or he loses his job, or, you know, then they lose their children. The children are taken away from them at the end. And it's absolutely tragic, but it was the truth. It was what was happening. It was based on facts. And I think it, you know, that coming into people's living rooms, comfortable living rooms, made people realise this is happening now in our country. It was a bit of a wake-up call. It's important to me, that film and everything associated with it.
So age 18, then you moved to London. And why did you move so far away, and why did you choose what you chose to study?
Well, that's the same thing. I didn't want to be very close to home. And, I wanted to be independent. And it's interesting when I see people today taking their teenagers to university, and they've driven them there and they've taken them there to look round, and they've bought a load of duvets and all stuff and shoved it in the car. I went on my own on the train with a small suitcase. You know, I mean, I wasn't indulged really. And, you move in, and I got there and I didn't actually have anywhere to live. And I had to sort of start by asking around, does anyone know anywhere to live? And they did have a student accommodation office, so I went and talked to them. But it was like, that was all down to me at 18. And I do think now, you know, young people can be rather overindulged and sort of the parents can do everything for them and pay for everything. So it was, you know, I had to manage myself, but I think at 18, I was probably more grown up than my own kids were at 18. You know, you had to take on a bit more responsibility.
Why was you growing up at 18?
Just think, I don't know, you just, people were more grown up at that
really?
Age. I think. And before I actually went to university, I actually had an older boyfriend and we went to America and hitchhiked across top of Canada, down the West Coast and across the center of America and back to New York where we flew home. But in that long holiday, that's what I did. But I did have somebody with me who was sort of more experienced. He was like 28, but that was a very eye-opening experience. You know,
But there's a risk there as well, isn't there?
Totally.
To be able to manage risk and to, you know.
Absolutely. And then after that, the first year I was at Brunel University, I went overland to India, again with somebody. But that was also, you know, went through, you know, Iran, Afghanistan, Turkey, India, Pakistan and places like that as a 19-year-old. Again, opened your eyes to how...
Would just travel on transport, the,
yeah,
public transport?
On local transport.
Really?
Yeah, from Istanbul to Delhi.
How did you do that? Did you save up?
Well, it was actually, once you paid for the flight to Turkey, it was so cheap. I mean, it just hardly... But I think we like to stay overnight. It was the equivalent of like 30p. But always basic. I mean, we never stayed in a proper hotel. It was just local restaurant that had some rooms where the bed was just made out of wood and string. And and I didn't have an actual bath or shower for weeks. I remember someone built a fire in Herat in Afghanistan and standing under a showering there. So I was quite adventurous, but when I think about how protective we are about young people now, we don't really think they can do that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, but just sounding like, you know, even just in this short piece here, you know, this adventure that comes in and this independence and this, are you stubborn?
I guess.
In a good way.
But the thing is, I'm not even sure my parents knew what I was doing, you know. They probably thought, you know, I said, I need some money for a plane ticket that I was probably going to Paris or something, you know, something quite mild. And then they got letters from Iran and stuff, you know. It was like, I found them. My mother didn't die. She died fairly recently and she had kept a lot of these letters. It's quite funny to read them. Just sort of writing everyday stuff. I don't think I was aware of the dangers. I think that's how I would put it, Michael, you know. Mm. You're quite naive in a way. Yeah. That trip across the States, you know, there were people with live ammunition shooting at birds and you know, loads of things happened to me that were borderline highly dangerous, but I didn't even really think about it because I had nothing to judge it by.
Mm.
I wasn't mature enough to know how dangerous it was.
What's it? Ignorance is bliss.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indulge me just for a second. What was Afghanistan like?
I absolutely loved it. It was like the most magnificent country I've ever been to. I mean, I've been to other great places since, but at the time we went to Bamyan, where the Mazar-e Sharif, where they had the Buddhas carved into the side of the, carved. And Genghis Khan had taken the faces off them, but then later the Taliban blew them up, so they don't exist anymore. But I've been there and I've seen it and I've walked and sat on the Buddha's head. So that feels like something quite special that not many people have done.
Mm.
But yes, people were very open. It was just a very nice, relaxed vibe at the time. I mean, I don't think it's anything like that now, of course, but this is the time when there was... a king of Afghanistan. It was, before the Russians. And it was just a relaxed place. I mean, I think it was relaxed because a lot of people were smoking drugs, but it was just very pleasant and a friendly and open place. Mm. Yeah.
You came back to London then. And what was your career path from there then? What was your jobs after university? What did you pursue?
I did, even when I was at university, I did various jobs. Even before that, when I was a teenager, I did jobs. I used to work on the market in the north of England selling fabric and so on. So I just took a range of jobs. I worked in the health service in a family planning clinic. I worked in a publishing company. I worked in shops. I didn't really have a career. I'd done 7 years at university, and I wasn't really ambitious to make a lot of money. I was happy doing my jobs, and I had, you know, groups of friends and everything. And it was really only after I got married and had the children that I realized I needed money. You know, before then I wasn't that bothered. But once you have dependents, then you know you need to get something sorted out. So that's when I became more career focused, actually in my 30s. In my 20s, I was just gadding around, really.
Well, what age was you when you had your first?
I think I was 28 or 9.
Sounds like a strange question to ask, but did you feel, when you had the first one, did you feel safe? Did you have good people around you? Did you have a community around you?
No, that's an interesting question, because my parents were in the north of England, and I was in I had a council flat because they were hard to let, unbelievably, when you think about it now, how difficult it is to get housing. But we were able to get a high-rise flat, which the person who became my first husband and another boy that we shared with, there were three of us in there. And when I was having the baby, we sort of said to him, would you mind going to live somewhere else now? And he didn't mind, because it wasn't that hard to find anywhere. But no, it was just me, my husband, and the baby. I didn't have cousins and friends around. My parents weren't there to help. So it was much more difficult than it would have been had I been at home. But of course, you know, women do make friendships and relationships with people they meet, and other mothers and so on. And you kind of get through it. But it probably was some of the hardest time of my life, having a small child that I didn't know how to communicate with. And she was crying a lot, and it was hard. I wasn't doing a job. I was at college. I was doing a city in Gills in fashion and design, and I had a childminder, but I used to come home at lunchtime, breastfeed the baby, and then go back again. So that week, she was only 2 weeks old when I went back on that course. But you make do, don't you, with them? You make opportunities happen, even though it can be a bit difficult. And then later, I mean, then I had two more children, but it is difficult to get childcare that's affordable. And at first, I was working really, and all my salary was going on paying a childminder, because my salary wasn't high enough to enable me to, you know, have anything at the end of it. So we were living on one salary, and mine was going on the childcare. And some people say, well, why would you do that? It's completely ridiculous. But I knew if I didn't have a job, I would go mad. And there was a time when I was really not clinically depressed, but I was very low. You know, I wanted to have perhaps the status that's associated with the job as well as the income. And I think if you are really all day with kids, it can drive you nuts.
Identity is such an important thing, especially if you look at, again, I'm thinking as you're speaking, so you come from a community, you then was adventurous, and now you're in a high rise with your partner and a child and then multiple children. Mm. Where you know, reflecting back on maybe what you were and what you're the situation you're in now.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were taking control of the situation though with the...
I think there's a lot of women probably experience what I did, but for me, going back to work and also going to the gym was important. I was able to carve out first thing in the morning. Eventually we got an au pair to come and live with us. So children were all in one room, so the au pair had the nicest room, but...
In the high rise?
No, this was somewhere else after that. But yeah, no, when I was in the high rise, I had a childminder. But later, when I had the three kids, we did get a house. We bought a house. But I was so keen. I just got up in the morning, really early, 5 or 6, and I went to the gym. And then the au pair had to look after the kids when they got up. But that time was my time. And then having the job. And having someone live in the house was quite good, because I just knew that they'd be okay. But all that time when I was working, when they were young, I was thinking, I can't have a job too far from home, because I might have to come back, or what if someone breaks their leg or goes to hospital? it was always on my mind. And I had a job in local authority. I went work for Brighton and Hove Council. And I used to say, I have to leave at five because I have to get back to pick up the children and so on. So I think a woman with kids is more constrained with the jobs they can do, but you do it. And it's important for your own self-esteem to have a career if you can, I think.
Age 35, you kind of, you took a different path really. And why did you decide to change to move into the housing sector?
It was just a random job. I was working, I think I mentioned the family planning job. And one of the councillors there, she said, oh, my husband's looking for someone. He works for a housing association. And the job I was doing there was coming to an end. It was somebody's maternity cover. I said, oh, well, give him my name. And she said, all right. And that, of course, I didn't even know what a housing association was. I really didn't. And so I went for this interview and I had to read up. And I thought, oh, well, that sounds quite good. Anyway, I got it. It was an administrative job. It wasn't a high-powered job or anything. But because that then was a permanent job, and because my youngest child was 6 months old and I was through with having kids, I then said, right, now I'm going to have a career. And instead of just doing odd jobs and stuff, I started really focusing on my career and had a plan. I'm going to try to, by the time I'm 40, earn 40 grand a year and have a car. That was my plan, because at the time, we couldn't afford a car, and I was really getting annoyed with having to walk around everywhere and go on buses with children and pushing a pram with somebody on a pram seat and another one. It was quite hard, and so I thought, I need a job that can get me a car, and so that is why I decided to stick that job in housing and keep on working at it and trying to get some promotion and get better jobs, and that's what I did.
What kind of housing was it?
That initial one is a company called Cargom, and it was set up by somebody who had also set up the Abbey Field Societies, which are for older people. But he set this up for lonely people, which, if you translate it, it sort of becomes people with mental health issues. But he had been very taken about loneliness, how some single people were just living on their own. And so he set up sort of group houses where people would live together, mainly older people, but not exclusively. And when I started working there, we were doing more for people with mental health problems and learning disabilities. So I was on the development side, in other words, the finding of land, building of homes. And I found that very interesting and intrinsically interesting, building homes and designing homes and getting planning permission and providing homes for people was very satisfying, particularly people who perhaps were coming out of an institution when this was care in the community, but where were people going to live? Some of it would be with carers on site, and some would be floating support where the support would come in. Some would be shared, and some of it would be independent living. And that's what I did for a few years as well.
And did you stay within supported housing after that?
Yeah, after that, I went to another supported housing supplier called Stonham, which was one of the biggest ones at the time, and that had all sorts of things, including care leavers and ex-offenders and what other things? Physical disabilities, people in wheelchairs, and
people with extra need and extra care.
Extra needs and extra care. Yeah, that was what it specialised in. And at the time, it was a very particular regime where the government gave money for the support as well as the house building. So it was a bit of a niche area. But from doing that, I then got another job working for a local authority, which had social services and housing together. And so I was the chief housing officer in that council, trying to make sure that particularly the needs of the social services were dealt with. So, for example, if someone was fostering or adopting children and their home wasn't big enough, we would manage to offer a larger home so they could take children. So it was much more linked up than a lot of councils would be. Or perhaps get a daughter or son to live near their elderly mum. You know, you can do quite a lot of these things in a joined up way if you put your mind to it. And so that was really, really good fun.
Is housing, it sounds like it has, but this treating the environment to make things better. You know, instead of just going, there's a house, put someone in a house, you'll be good now. actually the full environment needs to be looked after? Because that's, I just thought this was a new thing.
Mm.
But it's obviously sounds like it's not.
I think if you are providing social housing, it is a holistic service, and it's a service to a family or an individual that you're providing it for. You're much more than just bricks and mortar, as they say. I mean, it's a long-term relationship. It's not transactional. It's not like buying insurance or a holiday. We're here for 60 years with somebody, maybe more. And so they might move in perhaps when they are, say, a single mum with one child, and then later they'll get a partner. And so now they're a family with three kids, and then maybe he'll die or run off, who knows? And then maybe the children will leave, and then maybe she's got another partner, and then maybe they're getting old together, and then maybe one of them gets cancer. And then, you know, this is somebody's life story in housing. And all that time, that house might be good for everybody, but it might not be big enough, or it might not be adapted for disability. So the house and where it is a key part of the services they can get. You know, is there a special school for their deaf child? Is there a home care for someone with cancer or disability? Where they live and the services around them are all part of the same picture. So I think in my current job, I really do think about people in their home and their whole life, rather than just, as you say, meet your need today, give them the key and walk away.
Mm.
They are going to have changing needs over time, and maybe changing housing needs. Maybe the house has to be adapted, or maybe they have to, we have to try and help people move to a more suitable home. But then there's also the environment. Is there places for children to play? Is it safe? Is it somewhere people can feel part of a community? Can they have friends around and feel that it's a good, safe place to live? Are there gardens they can enjoy? Is it easy to get to the school? Are there shops? Is there a doctor's? All of that. I mean, the whole place where housing is important as well. So I think you have to take it all into account if you're going to provide good social housing today.
Have you always lived in London since?
Since then, yeah.
Yeah. And just go to Brighton. So what was your role in Brighton?
So I was the housing director there.
Okay.
Yeah, so in charge of all the housing.
So that was 2000. So in the space of 10-ish years, you'd gone from
administrator
role,
to a director, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was desperate.
Did it's you have like, your car?
I did. I got a car at Cargom. And yeah, that was quite important to me, actually, to choose a car and to feel that was mine.
But did it give you independence as well, especially
yeah,
the little
I
ones?
Guess so. I guess so, yeah. But yeah, things like just having the radio on and listening to stuff and having a phone in the car. There used to be something called car phones. You know, this was really quite exciting for me. Yeah, I loved it. Actually, I don't have a car now. I just have a free bus pass, which is fantastic, much better. But yeah, I was thrilled with that. Yeah.
And when did the opportunity with was it called Notting Hill Housing? What was it called?
Well, it was first called Notting Hill Housing Trust, but now... since the last 4 years, we've been merged with another one, so it's now called Notting Hill Genesis.
So around 2004, a role came up with Notting Hill Housing Trust. How did it come?
That's right. I was actually working for another housing association then called Servite, that had been set up by there's a group of Catholic monks in London. And they had their own housing association, but that particularly focused on older people. So we're still in the world of supported housing. And they had care homes, registered care homes, and nursing homes even, as well as sheltered housing and ordinary housing for older people. They had housing for families as well, but it was largely older people's housing. And then from there, I got the job at Notting Hill Housing Trust. That was a general needs housing association.
And what was the role?
That was chief executive.
And that's quite a big step.
Yeah. You know, I was doing giant leaps here.
Yeah.
But I don't, partly, of course, it's hard work and drive, but it's also, I think there was an opportunity for women, you know, that people felt they wanted to see more women leaders. So I think I probably did benefit from that.
Mm.
And I don't know. I remember in that interview, they said, what have you got going for you? I said, charm, drive and intellect, which is kind of a weird thing to say, but it's that sort of combination of being able to work with people, but also think things through and be quite strategic and then make them happen. That's what the drive is for.
Do you have compassion?
Oh, yes. I hope so. Well, I think I have to learn it. I don't think it's necessarily, for me, something I was absolutely born with. But I do understand the need for it, and I work quite hard at it. So that if somebody's annoying me, or I think I feel short-tempered with them, the only way I can deal with that is by thinking, I wonder why they feel like that. I wonder what's led up to them being in that state, or being aggressive, or whatever their life story is such a key part of what they are. So I don't think I was born compassionate particularly. I think it has been through experience of meeting many, many people. And one of the great, the wonderful things about the job I have is you go into a lot of people's homes and they often invite you in, and that's always interesting and always a delight. And you just see lots of people making the best of what could be quite difficult circumstances. And that's very, you know, it makes you think, gosh, you know, haven't they done well? So I think you do, for me, it probably was learned compassion rather than born with it.
I think that's the case for everyone. I think it's a skill. I think it's a skill that you have to keep on top of. And this is my personal opinion, but also the way your life has spanned out, you know, you've developed empathy. I don't think you have empathy when you're little, and I think you have to develop empathy. And then after the next stage is compassion. I really do. And I think if you can understand something, then you can start doing something. And I think with those two skills and your skill set, how has housing changed? What was the challenges in 2004 in the area? And sorry, this is a double question, which linked into, and what did Notting Hill Housing Trust do?
I think, I mean, to go back even further, it's an organisation that started in the 1960s at that Cathy Come Home time. It was another reaction to that. And people, I think, in a local church with a radical vicar said, let's do something about this. And they started buying houses in Notting Hill at auctions with people already living in them. So he was, you know, the founder of Notting Hill was going up against Rackman to buy the houses at really low prices, but they're in poor condition.
So Rackman is?
Rackman from that period in Notting Hill, yes.
Was he?
Who was he?
Was he a gangster?
What they used to do, buy up houses with, you know, poor people living in them.
Yeah.
And then they would get rid of those people so they could sell the house at much higher value, because at the time, tenants were protected. They had the right to live there. So they used to do things like put dogs on them, put glass all around, you know, make a place really frightening and dirty, and they would just try and drive people out who had an absolute right to live there and had a right to decent housing. But they did it, and then those people were cleared out, and then they had very valuable property in Kensington to sell, which is what happened.
So they went from one side of it was intimidation and violence, and then Notting Hill Housing Trust was founded with what we've just talked about, actually compassion and love for the community.
Yes. And we were able to outbid them at auctions to buy these houses with the tenants in, and then gradually we would improve the houses. I mean, what we would usually do, let's say you buy a house with 20 little rooms in it, you'd have 5 new flats, so you'd move, you know, the people into the new flats, and then gradually when that was empty, you'd do that up again. And it's often done with volunteer labour. And in fact, my school that built that shelter house, we also sent minibuses to London to sort of, or wherever, maybe Manchester probably, where we would do voluntary labour. And I went in houses and scrubbed them and, you know, really grotty places, trying to make them decent enough for a family to move into. Yeah.
And that was the founding of Notting Hill.
It was. And that voluntary ethos was very important in the early days. I mean, these days we're very commercial. We're very much a business. But that was our origins.
Who was being housed in the 60s? Was it migrant workers? Was it, how was it?
It usually was people who already lived in Notting Hill, already local people housed in Notting Hill, but in very poor conditions, with wallpaper falling off and families of 5 and 6 in one room. So they were housed there. The area wasn't fashionable at the time. It was called Brown Town, and it was an area of immigration from the Caribbean. And Ireland as well, Irish people, but there was a lot of poverty, But it was the only place people could live. And so they were in this these very poor conditions in order to have somewhere to live. And the trust bought up those houses and improved them and made gave people much more space and security.
You just said trust as in a housing trust, but I want to talk about trust in another respect as well. Did that start building? Did the trust start coming to a community where it had been frightened with these gangsters? Did it start building something bigger than what it was first out?
Absolutely. I mean, it was founded by a vicar who was a radical vicar, and he bought a house in Notting Hill that was equally falling down with water coming through and everything. And he moved in with his wife and four children. And they, through the Methodist Church in Notting Hill, they started a kind of ministry amongst people where they just tried to make it better. And people came for housing advice. And then the trust started growing as a professional organization. But yes, lots of people came together. There were we've got some original photographs of there'd like be a black bus conductor, someone who became a famous cricketer, housewives, using an old-fashioned word, beatniks, again, another old-fashioned word, kids, you know, lots of people wanting to make a difference, and they were collecting money in pubs and everything. So it was a sort of community effort to address housing conditions in the local area. That was our original.
But a real diverse mix.
Very, yeah. Yeah, I think Notting Hill's always been a place with a strong black community, and it still is. And that's, I think, one of the things I'm proud about the trust was that we kept people in the area. You know, there has been a lot of gentrification, of course. It's gone from an area of race riots and poverty and police violence against black people and so on to a very shishy area. But at the same time, there are still, because we have 4,000 houses in Notting Hill, still lots of ordinary working class people, black people, families, elderly people who are our tenants still living in that area.
It's a coin with two halves. Notting Hill, it's a real mix, and it has the character, and it's not Chelsea. It's different. It's very, it's, you know, you go to Portobello and all this kind of thing. It's definitely got character. It's definitely got what you've said there.
Exactly. I mean, the people who have always been there haven't moved out. And, you know, these were ordinary working class communities. Why should the people who were there move out just because the house prices have gone up by 100%, you know, or more?
Oh, yeah.
700%, yeah. Why should they have to leave that area and go to another cheap area? They came in when it was a cheap area in the 60s, and they're still there. And that is what, as you say, gives it a vibrancy and, you know, Notting Hill Carnival. People sort of own the streets and make it their own place and the market, and you can still get cheap food, and it's still a good, fun place to be. Some of the pubs are very ordinary, you know.
You said you had 4,000 houses. Was that, was in 2004, was that how many houses you had then?
I think when I started in that job, there was about 16,000, and today we have 66,000. So it's grown a lot. But that 4,000 is just in one borough in Kensington.
Right, okay. Yeah. And what were the challenges in 2004? Were they similar to the 60s?
Well, in a way, it's always the same, isn't it? If someone doesn't have a home, they can't think straight. You know, you can't do anything if you're homeless. It just ruins your life. You need safe haven to live in if you're going to do anything, have relationships, go to work, participate in society. You need somewhere to live. So that hasn't changed. That's a fundamental human need and also a fundamental human right. But the issues are different. When I first came to London, you could get a council flat quite easily. You know, I just queued overnight outside somewhere and got the keys the next morning. You could also, with three times your salary, afford a mortgage, you know, so people could buy a home at that time. London wasn't so overpriced and as it is now, where nobody under the age of 40 could ever get on the housing ladder, really, unless there's some very particular schemes available for them. And that's very different. So the economics are different, but I think the basic questions are always the same. There's always a group of people who haven't got good housing or can't afford housing, and that's sort of the market doesn't work well for this group.
And the group's changing demographically.
I think it's when I started in social housing, certainly in the council sector, there were quite a lot of people with quite good jobs, nuclear families with quite good jobs in council housing, where there wasn't a great big distinction between ending up in council housing or being an owner-occupier. It just sort of was a bit of luck, or that you ended up in one or the other. Whereas now, the only people who qualify for social housing are really the people in the most dire circumstances. People who are not just poor, they also perhaps have mental health problems, or they're refugees, or they're just have difficult lives where they need additional support, and only the neediest get the housing. If ordinary working class people put their name down, they won't ever get anything, because there's just not enough to go around. So it goes to the neediest. So probably now the difference is most people who are allocated new social housing are in dire straits. I mean, recently we had floods in Notting Hill and Westminster, and we had 300 homes that were flooded out. And I think we were quite shocked how poor people were. They had so little, and all what they had was ruined by the floods.
Was this just around? Was this in the summer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Few weeks ago,
right?
Maybe two months ago.
Yeah.
And there are people with they obviously didn't have any house insurance. They lost everything: their children's clothes, all their memories, all their books of photographs, everything. And so our charitable trust has made some donations to people to help them survive. But we're having to try and renew those homes. So whether it's refugees coming from Afghanistan, whether it's people who've had a flood, whether it's someone's just old and not able to get around in the home, housing is such a crucial part of people's lives. And I'm glad that housing associations exist, because we're another provider, if it's just down to the council or people making their own arrangements. But housing associations, have a lot of homes that are available for people. It means that we can do more.
How community is not just built on those that are most vulnerable. We still need key workers to be living in the areas and working in the areas. Do you guys fulfill that need as well?
Well, it's an interesting point, because I think the best communities are mixed and balanced. So you don't just have the poor all,
A ghetto. You don't make a ghetto.
Literally, yeah. You don't want to just make people who are very poor live close to each other. A good community, and Notting Hill's a good example. You have some very rich people. You have some fairly middle of the range people, and you have some very poor people, and people get by and live together okay. It makes it a pleasant place. There's not a sense of fear. There's not a gated community any more than there is a ghetto. So that idea of balanced community is something we've always had as a housing association at top of mind, so that if we build a new community, we're putting some social housing, we're putting perhaps some wheelchair housing, we're putting some first-time buyer housing, and we're putting some swanky housing and maybe some market rent housing, so that you start to build a community, not a ghetto or a...
That someone said to me recently about diversity. We were talking about, well, why is it so important? And I'd heard it somewhere, or we'd had a previous conversation. I said, well, wouldn't it be boring? Wouldn't it be boring? And then you look at Notting Hill, it's not boring.
Mm.
Well, I know we're talking about just that one area there. It isn't boring, but you mentioned something a second ago. But is it divided? Is it a divided borough politically? Is it a divided borough financially?
Yeah, I guess there still is a huge difference between people who have some money and people who, at the end of the week, really haven't got any money. That's a difficult place to be. When I said, when you've not got a home, you can't think straight. Well, if you haven't got any money at all, you can't think straight either. And, for people who have spent their money by the end of the week, that's a pretty desperate situation to be in. And we found, during the floods, that a lot of people were in that position. They had no spare money for any replacements at all. Mm. And I think that is, I'm not going to get political, but it shouldn't really be the case that some people have absolutely nothing.
Mm.
no savings, no surplus at all. Just live on what they can earn or get from their pension or other benefits.
And would that be because also, if I fell on hard times, I would have a big group of friends, I hope, family members nearby that would be there to lift me. But if we've got people coming in from different areas, and I'm not just going to focus on that small demographic, but it's a demographic that needs to be talked about, that might not be there.
Yeah, but also, like, you, if you own a house, you could always borrow money against it, couldn't you? Or in your old age, you could possibly sell it, you know, and use your money for care costs or whatever. If you don't have any assets at all, there's nothing to fall back on. But you're right about other people to help you. But I suppose that's what we try to be, is like extended family for people. I said it's a long-term relationship. I would like to feel that we care about the people we house as if we're a, you know, a friend or a relative. And, you know, on this occasion, use our charitable money to help people out in a basic way, because they don't have other people they can rely on.
Can I? This is an emotive subject amongst housing, and quite often larger organisations like yourself get demonised for it. And we've talked about it already, but as boring as this word sounds, repairs, it's such a crucial element, I'm guessing, with regards to, like, fixing the flood damage, getting people back, getting people feeling safe, secure, getting that community and maintaining that community. How does the organisation make sure that that's running smoothly?
Yeah, it's always very, very challenging. I mean, I think we spend $100 million a year on repairs of one sort or another. So that's a lot of money. And you need good people to manage that, and you need good contractors, you need good people specifying it. But it is quite complicated to get it right every time. I mean, all I can say is that with the last repair, over 80%, I think about 83% of people are happy with that repair. You're still getting 2 out of every 10 not right. You know, it's hard to give people exactly get it right. And it's always been a challenge. My whole career, 30 years in housing, I can't say I've ever run a really great repair service. I don't know how to do it. I mean, what I think now, after all this time, probably the only thing to do is to do a major renovation of the houses every few years, every 10, 15 years. In the private sector, they turn over average every 9 years. And when someone buys a home, they often put in a new kitchen and bathroom. They might do the roof. They might do new electrics. But we're not. We're just letting it to another family. We're hopefully leave it in a clean and safe state. But there aren't any carpets. You know, we don't make the house beautiful for people. We might give them a voucher so they can paint it. But, you know, there will be repairs to be done within a few weeks, obviously, because we're not tarting them up in any fundamental way. We're just letting them. And so people start reporting repairs, and then you're trying to fix them up. And I'm thinking now that what we should probably do is just do a major refurbishment every 10 years or something to make sure the house is in a modern condition, retile the bathroom, you know, make it like a new home. But of course, there's a huge cost associated with that, and our rents are low and we don't get hardly any help from the government. So I've got to try and have a think about how that can be achieved. But it probably means selling off some of the housing that's in poor repair in order to bring the general standard up, which is politically difficult. People go, well, why are you selling? You know, this way you're housing 66,000 people, and that's a good thing. If you sold, you know, 1,000 of those, that's 1,000 new homes you haven't got, but you're able to put that resource into bringing everything up. And it's a terribly difficult decision. I don't know where to go with it, really.
We'll get onto the business side of things in a second. 66,000 properties potential in need of, in some way or another, repair over a period of years. 66,000. Housing how many? Over 100,000?
Yes, over 100,000. And each home will have, on average, 3 to 4 repairs a year. Yeah. So it's quite a lot.
250,000.
Yeah, loads and loads of repairs. And you've got different companies, you know, running around. London's very difficult because people can't park. And at the moment, they can't necessarily get labor. And there's supply chain issues, getting hold of wood and glue. Everything is difficult. So it doesn't surprise me that we don't get all the repairs right all the time. It's quite a tricky thing to do. But, I mean, there's no excuse for neglect. And where I know about that, then, you know, we jump on it and do something about it. But doing everybody's, you know, fixing their cupboard or whatever, we don't do it as well as we could or should.
66,000 properties. You mentioned 300 floods of properties that were flooded. Can I talk about three properties that you owned in Grenfell? And I want you to talk about the impact it had on you as an individual running an organisation and the well-being, the health, the mental health of those around in that community.
I mean, really, probably in my whole career, I don't think I've seen anything or experienced anything like the Grenfell fire. I mean, right in the heart of our area. And as you mentioned, we had three flats in the block that we use for temporary housing. So we provide housing for homeless families who are waiting for a home to become available. And they're ex-council flats that we bought. So one of the families was completely wiped out. And another one, the older father died. And it was a period of intense grief in our organization because and we saw it burning. We went there, we smelt it, felt it. We had someone off our main board who's a tenant living in Ladbroke Grove. And we had a lot of staff who work in that area running boxing clubs or involved in various community activities. And it was, we were on the scene on the first day. We didn't know at that time whether our tenants were safe or not, and made lots of efforts to try and get hold of people. And so gradually, as more information came out in the news and more was released about how many people had perished, we realised that quite a few of our tenants had died. And yet still it wasn't firmly confirmed, so we didn't know if they got out or anything. And it had a big effect on the staff who worked for us as well, who knew those people and had worked with them and been in their homes and things. But for the organisation as a whole, I mean, I felt not just the grief and the shock, but anger that this had happened. Social tenants, you know, often coming from a background of persecution or whatever, coming to live in London, having somewhere safe to live, apparently safe, you know, and then it turns out it's not safe at all. And the quality of the refurbishment was so low that people were burnt to death. And that was very difficult for me to live with. You know, I had let those flats in good faith. I had assumed that the council's work on those buildings was safe. And it's what we do all the time. We let contracts, we employ people to do this sort of work for us. And yet, hearing the evidence now as it's come out, some of those materials were known to be dangerous and were still sold. You know, the profit motive was such that people were prepared to dishonestly present their products as if they were safe when they weren't. And so our tenants were lost their lives because the house that I put them into, if you like, wasn't safe. And that's a hard thing to live with. And I know I didn't personally create that problem, and I would never want to harm anybody, but they perished in an appalling fire where they were burnt alive. And it's something that stays with you forever. And I think we've rehoused the family who lost their grandpa, and they're still our tenant. And many of the staff who work for me, they're still, you know, very alert to these issues. In the rest of the estate, we had some homes that the council wanted to buy back from us so they could improve the estate as a whole. And we cooperated with them in selling those homes back. But the effect of Grenfell wasn't just the families directly affected, it's everybody living around them. And we have a lot of people living around them. And the kind of mental health effects, as you've mentioned, were really profound on young people in particular, perhaps, you know, people at school, people who everybody seemed to have a connection. Someone in my office knew one of the other people who died. The niece of someone who used to work for us had died. So we had a lot of personal connections in there. And then we took two young people who had been bereaved into our organization for some work experience because they couldn't go back to university at that time. So it was very, very close to home. And I think it affected me as an individual, and it certainly affected the organization. All you can take away from something like that is I, you know, vow to do better. Social tenants are often vulnerable, and the standards we set for safety and for quality have to be higher than we would set for ourselves, not lower.
Did you feel any personal guilt?
Yeah, I guess. I think that's how you would describe it. That just feeling of utter helplessness and appalling. I mean, I know I didn't specify what was built or anything, but, you know, every time a tenant dies, and it isn't that unusual, you know, there are deaths of tenants, older people perhaps who smoke and then they burn, and so on. This does happen. People who sometimes jump out the window taking their own lives. All of those times give me a sense of guilt that we didn't do better for people. And I think you need to feel like that, otherwise you're in the wrong job. You know, you need to feel a connection with the people and some sort of responsibility for them.
We've said it already, you know, that's the... I know a lot of good leaders of people and people who are at top of organisations, people who are within teams and everything in between that. And when you're compassionate, when you're empathetic, the problem is that the positives of how could we do this better to make sure it never happens again? What's happening now? How is this incident, how is it becoming a catalyst to make things safer for people who are potentially vulnerable, but also people within housing?
Well, you know, in the midst of all this, there's the inquiry, and there's the Building Safety Act, and there's government action and so on. And it's, unfortunately, people are seeing this as a sort of financial issue, which it is. But I think the need to get rid of all the flammable material from high rises is obviously the right thing to do. And where we had the ACM cladding the same as Grenfell, we took it off very, very quickly, and that's all been replaced. We had 7 blocks in that category, but we have a total of 150 high-rise blocks in London. And by definition, you know, London's going to have flats, isn't it? You know, and social housing organisations like mine are going to be housing vulnerable and poor people in them. So we like with a priority to get that stuff off and replace it. So that's a big program that we're involved in, and we're using a lot of our resources to do that and put that right. But for leaseholders, people who've bought a home, it's very, very frustrating because they may want to sell or move on, and that's not possible if they haven't got a certificate to say the home is fully safe and updated. And that's probably a 3 to 5 year program to put all that right. And people are very fed up with it. I do get why they're fed up.
There must be a lot of money that's needed, and people and asset and all the rest of that stuff.
Yep.
Let's go on to the business. And let me piece this. I'll put it into context. When you can see it from like a media point of view sometimes, where socially responsible, not even that, social valued organizations are put to the sword a little bit because they have to be business minded. But if they weren't business minded, they wouldn't be able to do the social impact. That crosshair, you sit right in the middle. And why does it have to be like that?
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because if you work in local government, as I have done, they're not allowed to make a profit. They can sell services to people, but just at what they cost. And every year, councils have to be supported with grants from the government or local taxes to keep them in business. And what we do is, because we make money, our call on the taxpayer is really small. Only 10% of our money comes from the taxpayer. All the rest is made by our commercial activity. So we're able to provide homes that the councils, in addition to what the councils are doing with government money, we are borrowing money and we're making money in order to provide more homes. Now, to me, that is well worth doing. It's like if you take the prison service, for example, if you were able to give a job to prisoners, they would be able to pay for themselves. But instead of that, they're locked in a cell 23 hours a day, which to me is ridiculous. If you ran a prison as a social enterprise, you would have prisoners doing work, maybe, you know, making things or computer work.
Upskilling and giving purpose and community.
Exactly, learning things that could help them in later life, giving them some purpose, maybe mixing with ordinary people while they do it and so on. Instead, you've got a failing system. And I think the idea of combining market forces, if you like, and money making with money spending and charitable work is quite a magic combination. To me, I'm a huge advocate for social enterprises and charities doing this kind of work, not just spending money, but making money. And therefore, I mentioned the mixed and balanced community. So in that mixed and balanced community, we've got some houses that maybe £1 million, £2 million flats that rich people are buying. And the profit for that is enabling me to provide social housing at £120 a week. Mm. What's not to like? I mean, some people go, you should have done it all as social housing. I go, well, yeah, money doesn't grow on trees. You know, you have to make it somehow. But also, we're not creating a place which is just social housing. It's a place that is a desirable place where people want to live. And if we're building and designing something that we're expecting to sell a £2 million flat, it's going to be of a quality that is good for everybody, I think, rather than, you know, the cheapest possible low price housing. We want a decent environment with trees and birds and water and
a nutritious environment. You want
where everybody can feel not ghettoized, but actually this is an attractive place to live.
So Notting Hill Genesis, as it is now, let me get this straight. So you house, so the social housing, do you develop as well?
Yes.
So you, again, correct me if I'm wrong, you borrow money off banks, probably extremely large quantities because you're in London, it's a value. You then develop and build the properties. You sell some at high cost to pay for the banks and the low rents of the social housing.
Yeah, and we do some low cost home ownership as well. So starter homes for people, key workers and people like yourself. Yeah, well, you know, you as a young person could get an opportunity with a cheaper home where people buy a portion of their home, the shared ownership. And so you've got a lot of different types of tenure there, and hopefully a community that comes together with a variety of people living in it, all with quality housing and all with a good service. That's the vision. Doesn't always deliver, but that's what we're always trying to do. Mm. That's the vision. And so it works financially as well as socially.
Can I ask, go full circle of your housing, talk about supported housing and the development of hostels. We've spoke a lot about homelessness, and we haven't spoke about rough sleeping, because I'm paraphrasing Ed Tetherly from episode 3. You know, that's the tip of the iceberg. But there is a need for hostels and supported housing. What are Notting Hill Genesis doing with that kind of subsector?
Yeah, we do have some of that sort of housing, single homeless housing. But usually we work with another agency like St Mungo's or Bondway or Refuge, other companies that look after a particular group because they've got the expertise. So they sort of provide the service and we provide the house. But in addition, like with the rough sleepers, recently we've bought up individual flats, improved them, and then the rough sleepers who because of COVID, were taken off the streets. Oh, okay. The sort of move on from the hotels is being provided by people like us. So we try and deal with all types of homelessness and all sorts of housing. So, yeah, there is a hostel situation where, you know, we're part of that, but we are more the family housing end of the spectrum. That's mostly what we do. Housing for families, 2-3-bed properties, one, 2 and 3 beds.
But you're facilitating, supported and
yeah, absolutely. Stuff. It's an important part of what we do. It's again a mixed and balanced community. A mixed and balanced community's got people who are care leavers and prison leavers and pub goers and church goers. You know, you've got all sorts living together, haven't you? So that makes a, as you describe it perfectly, you know, a vibrant community.
I mean, it's and also this ecosystem. You know, and again, it's just I'm thinking as we're speaking. You know, you've got maybe someone who's lived and maybe had a turbulent childhood, maybe, and then maybe ended up rough sleeping because of whatever reason, addiction, poor mental health, whatever that is. And the hostel and the supported housing is part of that ecosystem into, you know, what you specialise in and then growing and thriving as part of that close-knit community, really. Mm. What are the future challenges? What's the good stuff that's coming? What's the challenging, the issues that we're going to be facing as a sector, but also within your organisation?
Yeah. I think the big thing immediately is to get the building safety resolved, the fire in particular. I mean, there's also gas safety, water safety, asbestos, all of that. But the most important and most problematic is the fire risk, because a lot of buildings weren't built properly and we have to get the builders back to fix them. There is government money. We're going to try and use that. But at the end of the day, it will be quite costly and it's a very big job. So it's getting the building safe. And then we need to think about the green agenda as well to improve the quality of the housing, partly because of fuel poverty, that if people can't heat their homes, it's pretty desperate for health and children and all the rest of it. So we need to start to do something about that. We have about a quarter of our homes don't meet EPC 3C. So that's a sort of acceptable level of thermal efficiency. So there's a big backlog of work that needs to be done to do something about that. And then there's a tenant expectation, and people expect to live in a home that doesn't keep breaking down. And that's another bit of the vision, I think, for the future. That's looking after the stock. There's also the community, making it work as a group of people, but also just having it as a nice place to live where people want to hang out and be. Sometimes you go to a council estate or a social housing estate and there's litter or there's a rubbish problem or there's pests, you know. It's not a nice...
Antisocial problem.
Antisocial behaviour. The shops are a bit rubbish. You know, everything's declining, degenerating. And that's something we need to address. And that's something on my mind quite a lot at the moment. How can we make the place that someone lives in and the space around it better? And then it's just dealing with human beings with compassion and dignity, you know, treating everybody with respect so that they feel that they are understood and they are valued and they are treated well. And that we understand their problems and we help them to deal with what that issue might be, whether it's debt or addiction or antisocial behaviour or the kind of issues you've mentioned. That's the ideal of a wonderful service, and we never meet it and people get cross because we can't deliver it all the time to everybody. But that is what the aim is. That's what gets me out of my bed in the morning, that desire to give a great service in a nice house in a good area.
Kate, thank you so much, and we will leave it there.